So I'm Andy Parker, and welcome to Amherst Reads. I'm with Mark Costello, and we're here to talk about David Foster Wallace's The Pale King, which was published earlier this year, which is 2011, which has suddenly been reviewed a lot lately. Mark, you have known David since?
Freshman year at Amherst. Mm-hmm. And, we were actually in Stearns together, fourth floor of Stearns. And by the way, hi, Andy. Welcome to my house. Okay. Great to see you again.
It's lovely to be here.
He was down on the back then in 1980. Stearns was a bunch of triples. It was still wartime officer housing. It still had that 1945 feel. So Dave and I were freshmen on the same floor.
You were writing then also.
Well, I think like a lot of undergrads, I was messing around with it. But I mean, much later as freshmen, I think. I think that was something in Dave's case, which came out throughout his, 5 years at Amherst, something that kind of developed. As a freshman, he was a pretty, he was actually talking about going to law school and running for Congress one day. Very different guy.
Mm.
Brilliant, rail-thin, shy Midwestern.
He sounds like a David Foster Wallace character.
Pale King, it's funny to me that it's been a controversial book, and obviously, Dave hung himself in September 2008, so that's part of it. But it's funny to me that there's controversy because it is, in fact, the most recognizably human. I mean, there's 6 or 7 people get educated. They all become IRS agents, and some of them become monsters, and some of them become victims, and some of them become human. And we follow them over the course of 25 years. It's funny. In many ways, it's sort of a traditional book. And yeah, I think in many ways it certainly some of the education, the college scenes definitely are in some ways Dave's own development.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of Dave in this book, including the character whose name is David Wallace, who talks about an experience at a small New England liberal arts college, not named as Amherst, but looks pretty much like Amherst. Springfield, Mass. Is named in that passage, so it's Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
The circumstances of this book getting published are also, I think, pretty important to our sense of the nature of this book. This was not a finished manuscript that David saw through the press.
Yeah, I mean, this was a book he started working on. I mean, he was talking to me about tax agents as early as 1997.
Really?
1996 or 97. So, I mean, this is a book that was gestating in some form for longer than any of his other books, and he had sort of an elephant's gestation period with books. But even this was very, very long. It was unfinished. It was left on his desk. It was found that night. And obviously his intention was that it would be published, and his estate and his widow carried forward with that.
Do you know more about than what you can read in the preface that his editor and publisher found other materials, supplementary materials, draft materials, but nothing like a plan, an organizational chart of how all the different things were going to fit together, which leads you to the question of how close is the book that we're reading to the book that Dave may have had in mind?
Well, I mean, no one knows. I think, people have to be honest about the fact that this is a constructed book. Dave was someone who finished, finishing was a particularly important process to him as a writer. He was not, Coleridge, who wrote something and published his first draft. He was someone who agonized and who created many of the most important parts of the book in the last 10% of working on it, and he lost that 10%.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even know if it's 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a big gap in the book. I don't know. I mean, to me, it feels like the structure is right.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one. And I say that because I do think this is a book that's committed to 6 or 7 people who work in an office, taking them back, taking them forward, taking them into different places. It's a bit like Moby Dick in the sense of, you have these people confederate on a keel, as I learned at Amherst College, and they go off in different directions. And so I think the structure feels pretty close to the material. It feels right to me. I don't know about you, but...
Maybe about 50 pages in, when I realized that we were cycling back to characters, each time with more information about who they are becoming along the way. The surprise is that where they all end up, I think, that which even though you, by midpoint of the novel, you are certainly aware that it's about the IRS, still that these people with very different lives up until that, their IRS experience, finding them thrown together in the particular way that they are is a shock, because amongst other things it is so much like a traditional novel.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think there's sort of the beauty of the obvious at some level. Now, I mean, we can't know, Dave might have chopped everything up, but it is, I agree with you, it does sort of follow people kind of coming together, and then they go to very different fates at the end of the book, and it's also chronologically roughly, it's the 80s, 70s, and then we come into a space that feels like, now.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious if when he asked you about the IRS, did you talk about the great tradition of IRS novels? There is no tradition of IRS novels, I just want to make clear.
We didn't, so we had to make one up. I think he was, there is a tradition, though, of sort of the bureaucratic book, of bureaucratic absurdity, whether it's,
Kafka.
Yeah, preeminently and most greatly of all, the great insurance lawyer, Franz Kafka. Inspector General Ionesco or, Gaddis and Pynchon largely takes place Gravity's Rainbow takes place inside sort of four or five different bureaucracies. A critic once said that, Dave was part of a generation of systems novelists, which I think is a completely incorrect term. But, that's sort of off-putting that Dave is so utterly devoted to the IRS in this book, the reality of the IRS. But for me, he ends up sort of just taking a tradition sort of one level further, which is this bureaucratic novel. But there's no... Most bureaucratic novels, this is my observation, I don't know if you agree, the bureaucrats are the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But in this book, the heroes are people who have no satisfying sense of order in themselves. They're Pip on the sea or something like that. Nothing, they have OCD and they accept the sort of our IRS as a way of just getting through the day. Mm-hmm. And then most of them try to do decent things with it. So it's a very humane book to me.
I mean, there's a big question about that gets posed by the characters about heroism and the everyday. And what is it like to go to an office and sit in your chair? And I didn't know the term wiggle, sitting in your chair for 8 hours auditing returns, has a kind of heroism that one never would have imagined otherwise. There's another thing that I thought was... interesting. I'm sure somebody will write a dissertation about it one day. How much of the way that Dave wrote fiction mirrors the way some of the characters' audit returns. That there's the frenzy approach, where you do nothing for 3 or 4 days, and then you crash for in a longer period of time. That a completed return is described as little stories with all the meat left out, which is, of course, what a novelist wants you to be able to imagine that means. The way that bureaucracy here he describes as not a closed world, but the real world, the world we all inhabit, I thought was gets more and more powerful by the accretion.
Yeah, I agree. I think when people read this book and 50 years, they'll be struck at how committed to sort of daily life it is. The language is grotesque at times, and the sentences are Wallacean, but I think what people, that's one thing that will be struck by people is that he's really committed to sort of doing work and the world of cubicles and, Friday night happy hour, and you know, and doing work, the universality of work, that a poet can be like an accountant. I mean, you know, he's got a riff in the book about the word accountable.
Yeah.
You know, an accountant is a storyteller, the word for account, but he also uses the word accountable. I'm morally responsible. And to combine the account, the story, with accounting, and then moral account, moral responsibility, I mean, that's a very powerful, it's a mature writer.
It's a courageous book in a particular way. The book has been pilloried for, in some reviews, being a boring book about boredom, which, well, it names its subject as boredom, but the technical virtuosity in the book is anything but boring. So there's, if, for those who are reading the novel along with us at home, when you get to page 501, there's the beginning of an extraordinary discussion about boredom. And one of the characters, Drinyan, says that boring isn't a very good term to, and this is to name the work that he does as an auditor. Certain parts you tend to repeat or say over again, only in a slightly different way. These parts add no information, so these parts require more work to pay attention to all. Like, what parts? What in it is it that you think I kept telling over and over and over? I wouldn't call it boring, though. It's more that attending to these parts requires work, although it wouldn't be fair to call that effort unpleasant. It's that listening to the parts that do add new information or insights, these parts compel attention in a way that doesn't require effort. I mean, this seems to be, you know, one of the many asides to a reader, to pick up on the kind of effort that this book exacts from its readers, that you might find this boring, but you also might find the repetition with slight difference to create wholly new patterns, wholly new insights that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. Amongst other things, I was thinking that of David as a teacher, that not only a writer, but a teacher was the one who wrote those words.
And a teacher of writing, someone for whom educational institutions, Amherst, and you know, some other places were transformative, both as a student and then as a teacher. No, I agree. And to me, it's very sort of committed to the sort of terms on which we do actual things: read, write, think, whatever the work is that we have to do. It's not a finished book, so I don't know. I personally feel that between 1996 and September 12, 2008, Dave, you know, he became a simpler writer. I think a lot of those relatively undigested summaries of the Internal Revenue Code, I don't know if those would have survived the mature writer. I don't know if he leaves those in there. No one does. We never will. But the book as a whole, it seems the passages that, you know, like the one you read, I mean, that's... it's like a toothache. I mean, everyone's had one.
Here you have the first paragraph of The Pale King, which I believe is destined to be a famous first paragraph of contemporary literature, in part because of how unexpectedly it ends. So I will just read this with no further to do. Past the flannel plains and blacktop grafts and skylines of canted rust, and past the tobacco-brown river, overhung with weeping trees and coins of sunlight through them on the watered-down river, to the place beyond the windbreak, where untilled fields simmer shrilly in the AM heat. Shatter cane, lamb's quarter, cutgrass, sawbriar, nutgrass, jimson weed, wild mint, dandelion, foxtail, muscadine, spine cabbage, goldenrod, creeping charlie, butterprint, nightshade, ragweed, wild oat, vetch, butcher grass, invaginate volunteer beans, all heads gently nodding in a morning breeze, like a mother's soft hand on your cheek. an arrow of starlings fired from the windbreak's thatch, the glitter of dew that stays where it is and steams all day, a sunflower, four more, one bowed, and horses in the distance standing rigid and still as toys, all nodding, electric sounds of insects at their business, ale-colored sunshine and pale sky and whirls of cirrus so high they cast no shadow, insects all business all the time, quartz and chert and schist and chondrite iron scabs in granite. Very old land. Look around you. The horizon trembling, shapeless. We are all of us brothers.
Yeah, you know what? This is the first paragraph of the novel. And this, I think, is Dave's front yard at the second house he had in when he was a teacher at the Illinois State University.
In Normal, Illinois.
And it's just such a sort of how it steps outside your front door to feel alive, but it's a particular place. It's not just words.
You mentioned the Midwest. I happened, as I was reading The Pale King, I was reading Bruce Chatwin's travelogue / fiction called In Patagonia, which we're going to be teaching this fall at Amherst College in the English department.
Great book.
It's a great book, and I had never thought of that book alongside David, but the prairie and the role that the flatness, the shapelessness of the extended horizon plays in this work of fiction seems extraordinary, and I ended up picking up by happenstance two works about flatness, and the again the rap about flatness is usually it's undifferentiated, therefore boring, where in these cases it's undifferentiated, therefore an interesting problem. You also described this book as hopeful. Could you say more about that?
Well, I mean, the first thing, of course, is it's, you know, no one can say the book's hopeful. I mean, you know, if you come into it wanting to come away with an emotional tagline, then, you know, you should watch sports on TV. I bet, I mean, one can sort of talk, I mean, broadly, and to me this is, you know, Dave was struggling on two parallel struggles, you know, through his life. And one was to sort of, and you know this because you taught him and you had an important teacher of his at Amherst, and he struggled to control the sort of prodigious tools that he had and to understand that fiction is people, it's eye contact, it's also words on a page. And it sometimes can be sort of counterintuitive victories of words on a page, ugly words that are beautiful, cruel words that are compassionate, you know. And so he had to sort of figure out how to use all these different things that writers use, people, scenes, time, and words. And he made himself sick for years by, in his own mind, failing to bring it all together, failures of technique. And I feel like there's some victories of technique here, of bringing things together. Not perfect, it's not a last draft, but in terms of making his language live inside people that are fake is a huge achievement, and it's something that only fiction can do, I think. So I think that, to me, it's hopeful in the sense that you see someone get control of these things that they struggle to control all their lives. I also think, in the end, you know, you know, there seems to be a horrible act of violence at the end of the novel, but there are things that happen after that, and there are people who do come together, and there are people who do at some level understand each other, and so I think that, and I think it ends with a direct address sort of right out to the reader. To me, that feels like someone who feels like we can kind of go on.
It's also a historical novel, which in part, I guess, you write what you know about, and this was the era of the 70s and 80s, where Dave was a tennis prodigy and student at Amherst College. He knows all of those historical characters, the celebrities that were in the news who make fleeting appearances in this book. too. There's a way in which the most hopeful books I know are historical novels. You know, that they're trying to think about other routes to the future that, you know, that might bypass the present in some respects. I was surprised how, you know, how deeply but also seemingly effortlessly researched this book is.
You know, after Infinite Jest in 1995, he had a big celebrated book tour, and then he came home and sort of, I think it was a very difficult time in his life, and around 1997 or so, he started getting an accounting degree. He used to brag to me that he was just...
It was seriously?
No.
I just thought this was just going to school.
This wasn't research. This was, I mean... He spent 2 years taking a master's level classes in accounting at the Illinois State University, and he used to brag to me, and only Dave could brag this way. He'd say, I'm just a credit or two away from sitting for the Illinois accounting exam. And I was like, wow, you know, you really have a glamorous life, Dave. I mean, he was very, very into it. And it, you know, that's why I think the parts of this book that read to us as sort of fantastic, phantasmagorical, the sort of the accountants with this bursting, bleak inner life. I mean, he was, some level, that was sort of the box he got into in 1996 and 7. So he studied a lot of accounting. He loved accounting. He loved the huge puzzle. All the rhapsodic passages about the Internal Revenue Code are some aspect of his personality.
And also just a purveyor of great names of things.
Oh, yeah.
That there's a real enjoyment of all of those totally arcane names.
It's like the boring parts of the Old Testament, yes. Kings and Leviticus.
While he was writing this over a decade, he was also writing nonfiction and short stories.
Tremendous collection, Oblivion.
Right. Do you see, did any of those stories jump out at you in reading the novel?
Well,
did any of them feel like they were... experiments towards the novel?
I mean, I think that they're of a piece in the sense that a lot of the best stories in Oblivion, from my perspective, Oblivion's published about 2004, I think, are stories about really high-functioning yuppies who might have gone to a place like an Amherst or something like that, who have wonderful high-powered jobs, and it sort of explores the kind of chasm between the external success and then what's happening inside, the panic, the sense of not being good enough, et cetera. And, you know, there's a story, That Old Neon, in which someone narrates their own suicide by car from beyond the grave or from some fictional space that's heaven, I guess. So I think that there definitely, there was a period of time where he was interested in sort of how do we function? What kind of deals do we make to just function? And does the cost of those deals go up, you know, as we go on? I think I see a lot of a similarity or same themes.
David Wallace's character in The Pale King discloses to us that he is better known as a fiction writer than as a nonfiction writer. And he says this to us as if this were a nonfictional aside in the middle of the novel, which means this is nothing that you take at the text's word here. But this was a book that the novel was, the few times I talked about his writing after Infinite Jest, the idea that there was going to be a novel that would follow was something that seemed to weigh on him.
I think the time when he himself, you know, fantasized about being an accountant was you know, pretty, as one would imagine, a pretty bleak time.
This is again where I put on my English professor hat. There was a moment in Dickens's career where he was tired of writing to deadlines. You know, one colossal 800-page novel after another. It takes 24 months to do one. You start one immediately. He went on vacation to Italy, and when he was on vacation, he wrote his friend, the inspector of police, is there a job for me there? I want to do something else. And, you know, as a novelist, I know all about the criminal mind. And you know, I guess, fortunately, he came back and continued to write. But the need to imagine yourself doing something else, I really quite understand.
Yeah, I mean, Dave entered a PhD program at Harvard to become a philosophy professor. So I think, you know, it was a terribly hard life for him. A lot of things came together. You know, he writes about OCD, and he was definitely a very compulsive guy. He was a perfectionist of a, you know, airless sort. So in many ways, I think he thought writing was the worst career choice possible.
I also know that from experience, my own and others, that writing habits don't change very much over the course of one's life. I do remember Dave as an undergraduate writer. What was it like writing with him? This is something I've always wanted to know.
Well, Dave and I, as sophomores, wrote a humor newspaper at Amherst that made fun of the president and some members of the faculty, though never the English department.
I always check just to make sure.
Well, absolutely not. We were both English majors and very well treated by our home department and history and philosophy. But it was a sort of satirical thing. It was really fun to write with Dave because he was so, you know, productive, fecund. Everything just came out of his head. And Dave was, and you probably, people who know him, knew he was an incredible mimic. His ability to sort of do voices, do, you know, and just pick up someone's voice, someone's walk, someone's, you know, hands was, I've never seen anything like it. And it plays out in his fiction in terms of, you know, it's a very voicey fiction and he inhabits people really eerily. But he would do these voices on the page really quickly, which, you know, at 19 was a pretty weird thing to be able to see. So, I mean, he was fun. He was very, very maternal toward every single last sentence that he wrote. So he wasn't very editable, but who is?
Did you end up having to fight over who got to say what or keep what?
Yes.
I'm so glad to hear this.
Yes, we had to fight a lot. And, we, you know, you had to end up horse trading with him, sort of like, you know, there's a funny passage in the book about horse trading with editors, but, you know, and he usually managed to work it back in somewhere else. But he and I also, you know, so we also wrote a book together later, which was even less of a, flexible experience. But Dave was funny in that he, you know, for someone who's the boogeyman of his work, at some level his solipsism is being trapped alone. He was someone who, because of his talent, it was very hard for him to be on the same page with people just because he was really different, way ahead of everyone else. And yet I don't know of another person who needed friendship as much, who needed, when he was a student, yourself and Dale Peterson and a few others, being able to talk to you about something, he would work himself up for half a day. I'm going to go see Andy Parker. But Dave, just go see Andy Parker. He's a nice guy. And at that point, I think you were probably, you know, I mean, you're not much older than he and I were. So it's like, I really don't think Andy's going to beat you up. But then he would go and he'd come back and it would be like a very energizing thing. So he created barriers to connecting with people we needed to connect to, like professors. But then once he overcame it, it was an incredible lift for him. And that was sort of one of his life's cycles, was creating reasons not to do something that he needed to do. Everyone does that, but of course, Dave being Dave, he did it 1,000 times more extremely.
The solipsism is one of the interesting things about technical things for David is the way he has and hasn't represented dialogue in his novels. There's a technique that was made popular by Flaubert and others in the 19th century of free indirect discourse, where the thinking of the character is expressed in the voice of the narrator. And you see a lot of that in The Pale King. And it's a way of connecting, of moving out of the separation of the authorial I into the characters' minds that I find much more fluid than the earlier fictions. I find that David is much less hesitant to do that than in Infinite Jest. Some things may have gotten easier, paradoxically.
I think they got easier with the same amount of struggle. I totally agree. I mean, I think that in more pages of this book than in others, perhaps, you have all the things working together. You have someone who you have a sense of. You have the language in hearing in that person. You have the situation that they're in meaningfully contributing to sort of who they are. They don't just sort of stand out in a vacuum. And they change over time, over the time of the book, which means physically the first page to the last. So I agree, and I think the dialogue is much closer to how ordinary people speak. Even though it's full of all sorts of Davian paradoxes and all this, he's doing it through the voice of these Midwestern yuppies, these tired Midwestern yuppies who are at a happy hour hitting on each other.
Which is also funny.
Very funny.
Another question about your own writing here, of having Dave as somebody that was not only a friend, but a writing partner. What was it like? You were writing fiction when he was writing fiction.
Yes, from 1998 on, yes.
What kind of reader was he of your work?
He was an incredible reader in the sense that his, you know, he did it for a living, and he his ability to sort of comment on things large and small. He sometimes expected more structure than he himself ever gave a reader. Mm-hmm. So you would say, you know, gosh, Dave, you never knew you were that interested in plot. You know, I think it's hard for writers to read any other writer in a sort of any other contemporary writer because there's so much insecurity in being an artist. The society doesn't care for artists. It doesn't think it needs art. And so I think it's basically, in many ways, the hardest place for him to do that was as a critic. Words were hard for him, though. Everything that was word-related was a struggle.
1,000-page novels take a long time to write.
I guess.
I wouldn't know.
Exactly.
Do you know if there is more writing that will be published?
In terms of fiction, there aren't novels sitting around.
It's a shame to end it on the lack of more when we're also here to celebrate the muchness of what we have. So maybe what we should do is end with that and with our thanks to you, Mark, for this conversation and the invitation to come to your house.
You're always welcome, Andy. Thanks.